Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Later I'll talk to Dr. Jeffrey Lebosky about the healthcare system, but first, here's Richard Parker.
Rather like Elizabeth Warren, who has a plan for nearly everything, I have a theory for nearly everything. Something tells me Ms. Warren's plans probably hold more water than my theories, but listening to a couple of my favorite local musicians recently brought to mind my theory about different kinds of music and their levels of popularity. My idea rests on the principle that the better you understand something, the more likely you are to enjoy it. This explains why rock and roll became so fantastically popular back in the 50s and early 60s. It was basically a very simple kind of music at that stage, based in large part on the blues, but with teenage lyrics and louder drums. Easy to understand. The other night, I was noticing how one of my two musicians would elicit a smile or a chuckle from the other one. 90% of the time, that moment would pass right by the rest of the folks in the establishment. They, or we, simply wouldn't know what had happened. Of course, how many people are going to realize that a minor seventh chord with a flatted ninth has been dropped in there unexpectedly? It takes a pretty sophisticated ear and a similar understanding of music theory to appreciate when something that is novel is dropped into a piece and the result is a good one. Well, I spent a few minutes thinking about this difference between what a good musician hears and what most of the rest of us hear, and I came to a conclusion that I'd always sort of suspicioned but had never really investigated, namely that musicians, especially jazz musicians, mainly play for each other. It's all well and good that the rest of us can appreciate a good performance, and we can because most good music, well, it can be appreciated at more than one level. Few people this side of Zubin Mehta are able to follow everything that goes on during the performance of a piece of symphonic music, for example. But importantly, the overall effect of all these goings-on is available to all of us but the tone-deaf. You don't have to know a minor chord from a coal minor in order to have a chill run up your spine when the orchestra gets to the climax of Beethoven's Egmont Overture. This brings me to the famous dictum, De gustibus non est disputandum. This is usually understood to be a prohibition against arguing about matters of taste. You like vanilla, and I like chocolate, and it's useless to try to change either mind about it. But this simple understanding of the old Roman saying is faulty. What is implied by the saying is that we shouldn't argue about matters of taste. We should leave such assessments in the hands of experts. I've learned that there is wisdom in this interpretation of de gustibus. I figure I'm probably as perceptive as the average moviegoer, and I used to believe I didn't need a movie critic to tell me whether a film was any good. That was before I began reading the late Dwight McDonald's column in Esquire magazine. I've actually gone back and seen a movie a second time after reading his review and enjoyed it something extra because of his insights. I don't know that I would ever have noticed the hint of chocolate in one of my favorite red wines if I hadn't read a review of it by a person more experienced than I am. I liked it before, just like I liked the music Cabaret, but the opinions I read made my experience of the wine and the movie much richer than it would have been otherwise. The moral of the story, I suppose, is that one should learn as much as possible, or at least as convenient, from those who are more experienced and maybe even wiser than oneself. The more you know, the richer the experience. And maybe, sometime down the road when Larry or Chris makes the other one chuckle, you and I will get the joke too. This is Richard Parker.
In 2016, Chico neurosurgeon Jeffrey Lebosky won national recognition for his work in brain injury prevention. During his decades of practice in Chico, Dr. Lebosky has witnessed many situations where the healthcare system has failed patients. He wrote his observations in a book, It's Enough to Make You Sick, The Failure of American Healthcare and a Prescription for the Cure. Since this book was published in 2012, Dr. Lebosky has continued to research the healthcare system, so I have invited him back to give us an update. Dr. Jeffrey Lebosky, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy. It's good to see you again.
You know, before we start, too, I want to give credit to your wife. I see you smile because you know why she deserves credit as regarding your book.
Oh, absolutely. Most of the things that I've accomplished in my career, professionally and personally, are a direct relationship to Diana prodding me to do it or her idea to begin with. And she comes up with the big ideas and I help her implement them.
Well, why did she encourage you to write a book?
Well, you know, if the people in Chico remember 10 years ago or so, we were in a crisis here. The hospital was in trouble. We had a
– Enloe Medical Center.
Enloe Medical Center was in trouble. The quality of care had diminished. We had physicians opposing other physicians. We had physicians opposing the hospital. It became a really uncomfortable situation and was something that I certainly didn't expect when I entered medicine. And it was something that was a surprise to me. It took a toll on me psychologically. I became depressed. I found that I didn't like going to work. A job that I absolutely loved my entire life was no longer a job that I really enjoyed. And I couldn't get out of this funk. And Diana, in her wisdom, kind of said, you know, you need to change. You're not going to be a good doctor as long as you continue in this state of mind, and you need to figure it out. And one of the things when I was in high school, I was the editor of my high school newspaper, so I was always able to write. And she says, you know, you've always been a good writer. You love writing. Why don't you write about this? And it wasn't necessarily anything that I was going to publish, but it was a way of having me do some introspection and some research. And in doing so, obviously the end product of that was the book. But in doing so, I realized that the problems that we were facing here in Chico was not something unique to Chico. Not that it wasn't our fault, but it was the same kind of problems that were appearing across the country in communities just like ours. And there was a common thread, and it was the failure of the healthcare system. Most of us went into medicine to take care of patients. That was the job. We were there to care for patients, to interact with them. And as I had indicated in the book, one of the most gratifying things is not necessarily the income, which is terrific, but more importantly, it was the relationships that you formed with those patients. And we saw those relationships starting to fray as insurance companies began to intervene between the patient and the physician. And as a result of that, we found that we were no longer being docs. We were kind of this generic healthcare provider. And our patients were not patients, they were customers. And that changed everything. And as a result of that, I felt that we had to explain how we got there and why we got there, and thus that was why the book came out.
My guest is Dr. Jeffrey Lebosky. He is a neurosurgeon here in Chico. And a few years ago you started writing the book. Because I might remind people, you weren't a writer who just can find a desk in the attic and just devote yourself 24/7 to writing a book. You've got your main occupation consuming your day. So you had to do this writing, this research, in your spare time, if there is such a thing.
Right. Fortunately, I've always been an early riser. I find mornings, even since I was in high school, I've always found mornings to be the best part of every day. And usually I'm up before any rest of the world is. So from 5 o'clock until 7 o'clock, when I'd have to go to the hospital, I was able to do research. I would take a Wednesday off, and instead of playing golf, I'd go up and start writing. And for that two-year period of time where I did the research from the book, I used the mornings for research and the Wednesdays for the writing, never thinking that this was anything that was going to be published. You know, I thought that I was doing this for myself. It was a kind of a therapeutic thing that Diana had recommended.
In fact, the title changed from the time you published it again. I mean, you kind of did two versions of your book.
Right.
And the title of the first one was?
The first title was The Doctor Won't See You Now. In other words, telling patients why they're so upset with their health care. And the second title, which I think was a better title because it really said more of what was in the book.
I might remind people the name of your book. It's Enough to Make You Sick: The Failure of American Healthcare and a Prescription for the Cure. Now, you have since, and I mentioned you continued your research on the healthcare system. And what are you discovering?
Well, interestingly enough, I'm kind of glad, but I think what I said in the book has pretty much come to roost. If you remember the book, I praised Barack Obama at least for his paying attention to this issue, recognizing this issue, and his efforts to try to deal with it with the Affordable Care Act. But as I said in the book, the Affordable Care Act was destined to fail. And although there are people that will argue that it's not really failed, I would strongly suggest that it has. The problem with the Affordable Care Act, it was a lot of effort to get people insurance. And that's a good thing, to have insurance. The problem is insurance isn't insurance, if you know what I mean. Just because you have an insurance card, especially the insurance card that we see for many of the people that are insured through the Affordable Care Act, there's many physicians who won't see those patients. And it's not that they're bad doctors. It's just that they cannot afford with their overhead to see the poorly reimbursed patients on Medicaid. A good portion of the patients who became insured under the Affordable Care Act became insured by going from uninsured to entering the federal Medicaid program. And so now they have a card, but still nobody will see them. And what I've witnessed is that patients throughout the North State have terrible, terrible problems, life-threatening problems. And the delay in care because of the trouble they have navigating the system to finally see somebody has resulted in poor outcomes and even death. And so I think we pat ourselves on the back that we've got so many newly insured patients, but I don't think we've solved the problem. And I think that we need to do a better job of that.
My guest is neurosurgeon Dr. Jeffrey Lebosky, and he has studied the healthcare system, been involved in it as a physician. And I had the experience this past spring of being in France, and my traveling companion arm broke. We spent 9 days in the French hospital with staff, surgeon, anesthesiologist, and we were bracing ourselves for how expensive this care was going to be, and we were absolutely shocked at how little it cost us. We were foreigners. We're not even French. And I understand you had a similar experience in Italy. What happened to you?
Well, I was actually invited years ago to deliver a keynote address at an international trauma conference in Turin, Italy. It was in the winter, so it was cold. And I got to the hotel, and my room wasn't ready. So I just left my luggage, put on my overcoat, and went to a museum that I wanted to see. And as I was having my hands deep into the pockets of my overcoat, I was bounding up the marble staircase of the museum when I tripped. I couldn't get my hands out, and I fell forward and smashed my face against the white marble staircase. I mean, I was
You can laugh now.
Yeah, but... I'm in Italy for like 2.5 hours, and I have now just broken my nose. There's blood all over the place. Women are screaming, and I'm trying to tell them in my broken Italian that it's okay. I'm a doctor. This is not a big deal. It's just a broken nose. In any event, I was put in an ambulance, taken to a local emergency room and hospital, and I was seen by an emergency room doctor, a plastic surgeon who sewed me up, an ENT specialist who kind of straightened my nose out and packed my nose. I had a CAT scan of my facial bones. And I thought, oh my God, I only have a certain limit on my Visa card. This is going to kill me. And so when it was all said and done, I presented my Visa card and I said, okay, how much do I owe you? And they said nothing. They said, you're a guest in our country. Our health care for people is for emergencies is free because you have no choice. And so I spent a good hour with these doctors just talking to them about their health care system. And I said, wow, that's kind of interesting. I said, how do you do this? And they said, well, we if you had cancer, let's say, for example, you started having a cough and we did an X-ray of your chest and we found that you had lung cancer, but you were fine, we would tell you need to go home and get that taken care of. But emergencies are emergencies, and we don't want you to not get an emergency care. So when I came home and I was writing my book, as part of the research, I contacted a hospital in Washington, D.C., teaching hospital. And I said, okay, I've got a theoretical question for you. Guy from Italy comes and is walking up the stairway of the Washington Monument or the Lincoln Memorial. He falls and breaks his face, has a nosebleed, comes in, gets a CAT scan, gets a plastic surgeon, and gets an ENT guy to see him. What happens? How much is that going to cost him? And they said, that would probably be around $20,000. I said, okay. I said, so how do you deal with that? And I was told that they would take the person's passport and they would not be allowed to leave the country until the bill was paid or there were mechanisms in place to assure that the bill was paid. And it just became so glaring, the difference between the two systems.
Well, one reason I bring this up is that your opinions are based on research that you've done, but also your own experiences. If other countries can do this, can't we look at how they're doing it? Can we take some notes from them?
Certainly we can. The problem is who's taking the notes and who's interpreting the notes. We get told all of the time that America is the greatest country on the face of the earth, and America's healthcare system is the greatest healthcare system on the face of the earth. And there's certainly a lot of reasons to support those theories. But if you look at things objectively, I wouldn't suggest that the greatest healthcare system on the face of the earth would have so many uninsured people, would have women dying of breast cancer because they couldn't get in to see somebody, or they were told, we'll see you in 7 months. Or people or children not get immunized because they couldn't afford it. People being told, we're going to garner your passport if you get injured here. That is not the best healthcare system in the world. The other side of that is we get told all the time that people from other countries would love to come to the United States to get their healthcare. You know, that our borders are being flooded by people from Canada especially because they get such bad healthcare in their own countries. Well, if that fact were true, you would expect that the indexes of healthcare that are followed by the World Health Organization in countries with such a bad healthcare system like France and Germany and Sweden and Norway and Canada would do much poorer on those indexes than we would in the United States. And we're 37th in the world. 37th in the world. Now, the problem with that is that we spend much more. We're number one in the world in the amount of gross domestic product that we expend on healthcare, and we are also number one in the world in per capita spending on healthcare. So there's a disconnect. It seems to me that we're not getting our money's worth.
My guest is Dr. Jeffrey Lebowski, and he's a neurosurgeon who says a single-payer plan is the best option. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm here with my guest, neurosurgeon Dr. Jeffrey Lebowski, who has written a book on the healthcare system. Well, you have kind of outlined the problems, and most of us are very aware of the problems. And like I say, 9 days in the hospital with a surgeon and anesthesiologist in France, and the cost was so reasonable, and the care was, it couldn't have been nicer. The staff was nice. They cooperated, the various staff members, and the surgeon was very competent. We were just so pleased with all that. And yet here, I would be frightened. I would be, on top of whatever my medical problem was, I would have to worry about how the heck am I going to pay for this, even if I have Medicare. So we're aware of this, but what can we do?
Well, that's a good question. we tried to, quote, do something with the Affordable Care Act. But for all the reasons that I outlined in my book, that wasn't the solution. And I have become grudgingly but increasingly convinced that the only answer to this is a single-payer system. And there's several arguments that would support that. But you've got to be careful, because as soon as you start saying the words single-payer, they'll start throwing labels at you. You're a socialist. It's socialized medicine. Well, actually, single-payer is not socialized medicine, and it's naive for people to not understand that there's a difference between those two. But single-payer, I think, would solve the majority of the problems that we all talk about related to healthcare. For example, let's start with the simple thing about seeing a doctor. Well, currently, like I told you, there's a lot of people that have insurance in America's healthcare system, but they don't have access to care. They don't have access to good doctors. And what happens is that if you've got great insurance, maybe you get access to good doctors. If you don't have insurance, you don't get that same access. If we had a single payer, if there was – and we're going to talk about single payer, you know, there's ways of doing that. Some people talk about just putting everybody in the Medicare program, which to me seems like the simplest way. You could create a new bureaucracy if you want and have a privately run, non-governmental single payer. But it's one insurance company. And the advantages of that is that every human being in this country, from the moment that they are born till the moment they die, have insurance. But more importantly, they have the same insurance. So Bill Gates or Jeff Lebowski or Nancy Wiegman don't have any advantage of the homeless guy that's sitting on the street here in Chico. We all get the same access to care, which means the same access to mental health, same access to pharmaceuticals, the exact same access. It isn't based on your socioeconomic status. So the egalitarian concept of a single payer and everyone getting the same, that means our senators and congressmen in Washington who sit in rail all the time, well, guess what? You're going to have the same insurance I do, so you better make sure it works for you. If it works for me, if it's going to work for you. So that's one advantage. I think the second advantage is the fact that because the single payer has just one insurance company, it makes it much simpler for physicians. You know, right now we have 5, 6, 7, 8 different insurance companies that we're dealing with, and it's a nightmare because each of them have different regulations, different reimbursement schedules, what they'll allow, what they won't allow, paperwork that forces.
This is why, if I were a physician, I wouldn't want to go into private practice for that very reason of all the paperwork that I'd have to hire people to do.
Private practice is becoming a thing of the past, and I really do believe that in the future we're going to see most physicians aligned with healthcare systems such as Kaiser Permanente. I think that's what we're going to see in the future. That's where we're heading. Most physicians that are coming out and from medical school now are saying, I don't want to go open a practice. I want a salary. I want job security. I want you to do my paperwork. Just let me be a doctor. And let me be a doctor that can order what's right for the patient, not order what's going to make the most money for your practice. And so I think that we're going to see that it's going to be that way in the future. And so if we have just one insurance company, it simplifies things. There's one set of guidelines. There's one set of forms. There's one set of reimbursement. There's one set of thing that they'll allow you to do. So there's no confusion, and you have significantly reduced the overhead. I mean, that's one of the advantages of a single payer. Look at Medicare, for example. Medicare deals with a lot of patients, and by the way, a lot of very sick patients. You know, so it's kind of not the best insurance company if I were an investor, because a good portion of Medicare patients utilize a fair amount of resources, as opposed to the private insurance industry, where your goal is not to provide care. I mean, listen to this. This is very important. Your goal, and it's an important goal, you have a fiduciary responsibility to your shareholders to make a profit and to maximize that profit. How do you do that? Well, think about it. What you do is you say, I want people in my plan that don't use resources but pay their premiums. And I'd rather get rid of patients who are going to eat up my premiums, and so they cherry pick only the good. Now, the Affordable Care Act changed that and said you can't refuse insurance to somebody, but the rates can be so high that you might as well refuse it because nobody's going to pay that amount. So I think that is a big advantage for them. Third, you look at what you can do in terms of the pharmaceutical industry. Now, there are people that really want to have the pharmaceutical industry regulated in terms of what they can charge for a drug. And this might surprise you, but I disagree with that. The pharmaceutical industry is a free enterprise business. If I'm making a table that we're sitting at here with my own design and my own labors, I should be able to charge whatever I want for that table or that car or that refrigerator. If I, through my own design, make a drug that saves lives, I think I have a right to charge whatever I want. And now those of you that'll push back will say, no, that's not right. You're dealing with people's lives. You shouldn't be able to charge so much that people are going to die because they can't afford it. I agree with that. But if you start telling pharmaceutical companies you can only charge this much for a certain drug, you're going to see their efforts to try to bring new drugs to market are going to be diminished. I think the best way to deal with the pharmaceutical companies is to say, okay, look, I'm the only insurance company in town. Now, if you've got a life-saving drug for cancer, but you're charging a bazillion dollars for it, and you've got a bunch of these other drugs for high blood pressure and diabetes, if you're going to gouge me on the life-saving cancer drugs, then our insurance company, which is the only one in the country, is not going to buy your high blood pressure drugs, and we're not going to buy your diabetes drugs. That's one way you can do it.
So you have some leverage.
You have some leverage, and you can do the same thing with medical devices like screws into the spine or cardiac pacemakers, artificial hips, those type of things. And the argument by that is that, okay, single payer, for example, Medicare for all, single payer is a monopoly. And that, in my book, that's what I argued was the downside of single payer. It is a monopoly. But I'm willing to live with a monopoly because everything else that we've tried has failed.
My guest is Dr. Jeffrey Lebowski. He's a neurosurgeon in Chico, and he wrote a book, It's Enough to Make You Sick, The Failure of American Medical Care and a Prescription for the Cure. So single payer is what you're recommended. And I'm wondering if young doctors, men and women, there are a lot of women now in the profession, are going to look at this, and I call it a mess, of the healthcare system and say, I don't want to be involved with that. I used to think I wanted to be a doctor. I don't want to go to medical school now. So are we discouraging potential doctors with this system that we have now and we have a doctor shortage and we're having to import, that's the word I want to use, doctors from other countries to fulfill the need?
Well, we do have a doctor shortage. And we have met that need, and not very well. We've met that need two ways. We've invited physicians from other countries to come and work here. That's good for us, but it's bad for their native country. Remember, some of these countries are nowhere nearly as developed as ours, and their population are screaming out for medical care. And we take their best and their brightest and let them get trained at their cost in their country. And then we say, come on over here, and we're going to steal you. I think that there's something morally bankrupt about that idea. The second thing we're doing is expanding mid-level practitioners. And those are like nurse practitioners, physician's assistants, for example. And I think that that's a good idea in some regard. For example, a good portion of our daily practice of medicine, whether it be managing uncomplicated diabetes or high blood pressure or mild chronic low back pain, et cetera, can be managed very efficiently and competently by a well-trained nurse practitioner or PA. And it's cheaper than a physician. And we should concentrate on the physicians dealing with the more complex issues. The problem with that is that many times these PAs and these nurse practitioners really don't understand some of the basics, and so what happens is they're just triage areas. They come in and you say, Nancy, hi, my back is sore. And then say, okay, we'll order an MRI scan of your back and then we'll send you to the specialist. I can hire a high school kid to do that at probably a lot less than I'm paying a PA. So these PAs and these nurse practitioners, which I do think is a good idea, need to take a more active role in terms of controlling the costs by utilizing the resources we have much more efficiently and not overutilizing them.
My guest, Dr. Jeff Lebosky, and this name, Jeff Lebosky, became famous. Dr. Lebosky, you have a fame of a different sort.
Yeah.
And you share the name of an actor in The Big Lebowski.
The Coen Brothers movie, yes.
Yeah. How did that come about?
So a couple of interesting little anecdotes about that. When the movie first came out, before it even hit the theaters, there was just signage about this Big Lebowski. And I was in the operating room talking to my nurses, and they were joking around and saying, well, hey, doc, is this about you? And I said, making this up as I went along, I said, oh, no, I actually operated on Ethan Coen, and he was so grateful. He asked what he could do, and I told him I wanted to be in one of his movies, and he told me he couldn't do that because I didn't know how to act, so he'd name a character after me. Now, I made this up knowing nothing about the movie, not knowing anything about it. And so when a bunch of us went to the movies the first night to see it, and not only was the character named Lebosky, but it was Jeff Lebosky. I could not get people in town to believe I was lying the first time. Then I thought I was going to get in trouble for a HIPAA violation for making up that Ethan Coen had a brain tumor. And then a few years ago, if you guys remember, Jeff Bridges brought his band The Abiders to Laxon Auditorium, and Deanie and I were sitting in the audience. And all of a sudden, in the middle of the thing, he just says, I really like playing the dude in The Big Lebowski. It was one of my favorite roles. But I understand you guys have your own dude here in Chico, but he's not a loser like me. He's a brain surgeon. And he asked me to stand up. And I don't know how he found out about that, but he asked me to stand up. And then I had a conversation with his lead guitarist, who actually had a brain tumor removed by one of my good friends at UC San Francisco, where I teach. So it's interesting. Fun aside.
Well, so I'm expecting maybe one of your books is going to be a novel. If you can invent a story like that,
I know.
I think there's a novel in your future.
Well, my nieces and nephews call me Uncle Liar because when my niece was young, I was sitting in the back seat. She lived in New York, and where my sister lives. And as we were driving to school, I was in the back seat with her all the time when I was visiting. And I told her one day that I used to play shortstop for the Yankees, and then I told her that I was an astronaut. And my sister got a phone call from my niece's teacher and said, we understand that your brother used to play for the Yankees. He's an astronaut. Could we have him come in and talk to the kids? So all of my nieces and nephews, I'm Uncle Liar to them.
Well, so one of your alter egos you just mentioned was an athlete, and you're quite a sports fan too, aren't you?
I am. I'm a tried and true Dodger fan. I'm sorry, folks, but... Yeah.
But you are serious, and of course you're serious about being a baseball fan too, I'm sure. But this topic of the single-payer plan, when you are serious about this, you present yourself as a professional, and we would tend to listen to you because if you're saying single-payer is the way to go, you have researched it, you have experience in this. How successful have you been in convincing other people that this is the way to go?
Well, you have to understand, Nancy, I've come to the party late. When my book came out, I had indicated that single payer was certainly an alternative, but that for the reasons that I described, the fact that it was a monopoly, that I thought that we could do better by just getting a government-sponsored alternative health insurance plan that people could sign up for if they weren't happy with the private insurers. But as I looked at this more and more, the bureaucracy is crazy. I mean, the average insurance private insurance company pays about 18% all the way up to 30% of their premiums on overhead. Medicare is at about 2% for overhead, which means that the rest of that money goes to patient care. And so it seems to me that Medicare would be the way to go. This is not my idea, and there's a lot of people who are a lot smarter about this, even locally, than I am, who've been pushing single payer for a long time, not only locally but across the country. As I see it, they haven't made much progress. I mean, the first person that talked – well, Teddy Roosevelt kind of thought about it a little bit at the turn of the century. But Harry Truman was really one of the first ones that was talking about a universal healthcare system. And so for 70 years almost, we really haven't made much progress. And what I find very interesting is that when Obama was elected president, he was elected with a filibuster-proof Congress. So he had the keys to the kingdom. And if they really wanted to push a single payer, that was the time. But it didn't work. And the reason it didn't work is because the opposition are very good at demonizing those who support single payer. What they'll do is they'll label you socialized medicine fan. And we think of socialized medicine and then we get told how bad it is. Single payer is not socialized medicine. England is socialized medicine. Canada is single payer. And there's a big difference in those two systems. In any event, I think that the problem with the single payer lobbyists is that they just don't present themselves well. And I'm not trying to demean anybody locally because I love the people locally that are behind this. I've had lots of conversations with them. And they were instrumental in forming my ideas and changing my opinions. But if you look oftentimes, the people that support single payer tend to be more to the left politically. They're the same people that are walking around with the medical marijuana t-shirts and the stereotypes that everybody tries to put on the left. A good example is several years back, a local group of the single payer advocates asked me if I would attend a lecture that was going to be done over at Chico State by a group of three physicians who were coming from, I believe, either Washington or Oregon. And it was called I'm Mad as Hell and I'm Not Going to Take This Anymore tour about single payer. So I came there and here's three physicians. They have ponytails. They've got tie-dyed shirts. They got jeans on and I'm fine with that. But there's a whole population of people that look at the way they dress and they all of a sudden get turned off and they don't listen to the message.
They dismiss what these guys have to say because they don't present themselves in a professional
way. And they started off – this is ironic because they start off with I think it was an emergency room doctor who was talking about inadequacies. And he said, do you know that in this country – a brain surgeon makes three times what a pediatrician makes? That's ridiculous. And of course, the crowd goes crazy. And he didn't realize that I was invited and that I was a brain surgeon. It's a class warfare thing. They're not only taking class warfare and instead of saying, how about the big business guys and the insurance companies, they're saying even within medicine, how about the high-end earners like neurosurgeons and the lower-end enders like primary care? And they're trying to pit us against each other. And the message that they gave supporting single payer was terrific. The audience was sparse. It's the same audience that, the people that are community members that stand on the corners on Saturday pushing peace. I love those folks. They're great. And I believe in their message. They were the ones that were in there. You didn't see the Chamber of Commerce. You didn't see the bankers. You didn't see the movers and shakers who kind of control this country. And in order for them to move this agenda forward, they're going to have somebody in a three-piece suit and a vest, walk in with a tie and appeal to these skeptics who want to label everything as liberal. And not appeal to them on humane grounds like many of us feel. This is morally wrong to not have this system, because those people don't respond to that. You got to appeal it where it hits them in the pocketbook and say, look, I know people are dying because they're not getting care. That's really not your problem. What you got to worry about is that you're going to lose your business, because as healthcare costs go up, that cost burden is going to be put on your business.
So if I'm a businessman, my ears go up. Tell me about this.
And you're going to say, you're not going to compete in the global market if we're going to start spending 23% of our gross domestic product on healthcare in the future.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I have more questions for Dr. Lebosky. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Dr. Jeffrey Lebosky, who has written a book, It's Enough to Make You Sick, The Failure of American Healthcare and a Prescription for the Cure. Your book, Dr. Lebosky, was published in 2012. We're several years past that now. Have you seen change?
Well, some change. I mean, I think that we've seen that more people are insured. And we were told, if you remember, we were told that, one of the big problems is that our emergency rooms are inundated with patients who had no insurance. And the nice thing about the Affordable Care Act is everybody's going to have insurance, so they're not going to have to go to the emergency rooms for their colds and flu. Didn't work. Last year, Enloe Hospital saw more patients in our emergency room than we have in our history, and it's growing exponentially. We're already outgrowing the hospital expansion that we created just a few years back. And what's happening is that our emergency room is getting filled with these same patients who come in with their colds and flus and earaches, but now they have a Medicaid card. But there's no doctor in the community that's going to see them. And so they just flop in the emergency room. So it didn't solve that problem. It didn't solve access to care. It didn't solve improving the quality of care for patients. And so I think that and the other thing that's absolutely abhorrent to me is how they took out the individual mandate that says you have to buy insurance or we're going to deduct it from your tax returns. That's key. That is absolutely key. And I can't understand how the opposition doesn't get that. And their idea is, well, that's you're forcing them to buy something they don't want. Well, that's fine, except when they get in their car accident or they get their lung cancer and they don't have insurance, is it okay for me to say, well, we're not going to take care of you? That was your choice.
So the doctors that don't accept these plans are driving the patients to the few who do.
Correct. But again, Nancy, I want you to understand, it isn't that these are bad doctors. These are good doctors who would love to accept these patients. If you're running your office, you cannot afford your – with the overhead here, it isn't like when they cut reimbursement to physicians through Medicare and Medicaid, it isn't like they said, oh, by the way, we're also cutting your utilities bill and we're cutting your overhead bill for your staff and your rent. Rents and staff continue to rise, and you cannot afford to see those patients in your office and keep your practice going. So these are not bad docs. These are good docs who'd like to see them but can't.
Well, what do you think would be the first step that we could take?
Well, there's one step that we have to take that the rest of this becomes moot if we don't take it. And that's where you have to get the money out of politics. The Supreme Court ruled that corporations are people and they can give unlimited amounts of funds to as part of free speech to support political processes. So who do you think has the money to support that? Do you think the executives from the insurance companies have more money than these sweet women that stand on the corners of First and or Third and Main and wear flowers and talk about peace? Who has more money? So do you think their agenda is going to be pushed, or is the insurance company's agenda going to be pushed? As long as I can buy myself a couple of senators and a handful of congressmen, and you who happen to oppose me can buy yourself a couple of senators and a few congressmen, nothing's going to change. So, I mean, this is fun intellectually to talk about this stuff, but in my opinion, nothing will change until we take the money out of politics. Make a law that says, guess what? You can only donate $100 to any candidate. $100 isn't going to buy you influence. And, you know, $100 is not going to buy you influence. And then our Congress people are going to be free to vote as they should, not where the money tells them to vote. Yeah, I think we should put term limits. It's crazy when people are congressmen for 40 years. That's not how the government was designed. We wanted new and fresh ideas, and we're not getting them. So I think there should be term limits on senators, term limits on congressmen. And the argument is, oh, you don't want to do that because they're now very seasoned and they know how to play the game. And there's something to be said for that, to know how politics works. But I think when even really good politicians who I admire are in their 80s and 90s and still running for office, it makes no sense to me. So I think taking the money out of it, putting term limits in it, until we do that, this is just an interesting conversation between the two of us.
Well, there are going to be people who hear you say, maybe they got in their car, they didn't hear your explanations, but they hear you say single payer and they bristle. What do you say to people?
I'm not one of those guys. No, that's a trouble. You know, this is almost like coming out of the closet, you know, to come here and say, I support single payer, because I think one of the reasons that people respected me and trusted me and listened to what I said is they thought I was reasonable. And one of the risks for me to even be here with you today is that now people are going to just put a label on me and say, oh, he's one of those guys. He's a single payer guy. And it doesn't change how reasonable I may have or may or not have been, how thoughtful my ideas may or may not have been. Don't put a label on people. And I don't think that we should – I think that if we put – it's easy to put labels on people because then you don't actually interact with them. You can just make assumptions about them and go
– And you don't have to listen to their argument or what they have to say.
You don't have to listen to the argument.
You just put them in this pigeonhole and say, oh, okay.
And,
well.
And I, you know, certainly what I'm saying is my opinion based on what I've read and what I've studied. I'm certainly open to sitting across the table from somebody who says this isn't going to work. Single payer is not going to work and here's why it's not going to work. And I'd like to have that discussion with them and understand why it's not going to work. I'm open to that. Because I don't pretend to have all the answers, but I just think I am so appalled when I get patients now from Reading who have a brain tumor and can't find somebody locally to take them out, and the patient waits 2 months, and all of a sudden they said, "Well, there's a guy in Chico that'll see you." That's appalling. And again, I'm not blaming the guys in Reading. What I'm blaming is the system.
Exactly. You've mentioned that. And maybe this is a point I should remind listeners that the opinions that you're expressing are yours, not necessarily the opinions of North State Public Radio.
I was told they were. I thought you guys agreed with everything I said.
Well, certainly. So the people that come to see you sometimes have not been able to have their first choice. I mean, if I lived in Reading, I'd want to go to a surgeon in Reading.
Correct.
And you're saying, and I want to emphasize this point, you're saying it's the system. We can't blame any one person. The system, the medical system, the healthcare system, the political system, And this is where we have to attack the root of the problem.
But, you know, if we spend a lot of time trying to attack the healthcare system before we change the political system, I don't think we're going to succeed.
I think that's an important point to make. I sometimes look at educational system and how much that needs reform, but it is a system. And that's much harder to reform systems.
It is, but it's necessary.
Yeah, and I really admire the courage, because I do feel it took courage for you to come in today and propose, give us the reasons you have found, because you've done the research, you've had the experience, the reasons you believe single payer is the way to go.
Well, I don't think you could characterize it as courageous. I mean, there are a lot more courageous people than I that have been pushing single payer systems. You know, Ken Logan and the guys here in town have been doing that for a long time, and they're out there by themselves. That's courageous. You know, to come at it late like I have is just to kind of join their bandwagon.
Because I have a friend in her 90s, and she has said she is all for single payer and has been for years. And she says, I will not live to see the benefits of this system, but I want to do what I can for future generations regarding single payer.
That's courageous.
Thank you so much, Dr. Lebosky.
Thanks for having me. Good to see you again, Nancy.
My guest has been Dr. Jeffrey Lebosky, and his book, It's Enough to Make You Sick, The Failure of American Healthcare and a Prescription for the Cure.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.